The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way. Where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
Let me ask you this, though. Is it one of your Desert Island records?
That's always such a tough question. Do I have a number of albums I'm allowed to bring?
Always 10 is usually the benchmark.
Oh, shit. I'd put it in my top 20. If you allow me 20, I'm putting it in there.
10 is the rule.
It, you know what it is, though? Like, so I'll definitively say no, it wouldn't be in my top 10. But
Dave's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and riding beside me on this information superhighway is none other than Rob Janicki.
Hey, Keith, how are you?
Rob, I gotta tell you, I'm not feeling any older, and God knows I'm not any wiser.
The last job I did for him was a series of pictures to illustrate a story in a cheap magazine.
That's fine. How did you like being tied up?
Oh, it wasn't so bad.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, Rob and I chose to celebrate the midway point of season 2. And this is also the midway point between our respective birthdays. Happy belated birthday to you, Rob.
Thank you very much, Keith. And almost happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you, sir. So, in honor of that, he and I have each selected an abandoned album of our own that the other one does not know about. And I think while we're on the subject of abandoned albums, Rob, I think we should clarify. I think there's a lot of confusion around what we mean by abandoned albums. They could be successful albums, and ultimately what this podcast really is a conversation between ourselves and the artist, and the entry point is that album. And then the conversation, as conversations are wont to do, go all over the place, you know? It doesn't necessarily zero in and focus on one particular album after a certain amount of time. It flows. Like all conversations, what am I saying? It's fluid, right?
You're right. These albums mean something to the artists, obviously. Spent a lot of time in their lives creating it and putting it out. So they're certainly not abandoned by the proper definition of that word. You know, we're here to, I always tell people, you know, really just to remind fans that this one exists and it's really good and you should kind of get back into it, or maybe younger fans, depending on who we're talking to. And this is a good way for them to maybe get into that artist.
We've regrettably been poo-pooed by a few artists who are like, well, that album's not abandoned. Well, no, it's not, but it's 30 years old, so maybe it's just a little refresher, and from there we can talk about what you're doing now, which is more important. Folks, if you're hung up and think that whatever albums we select are abandoned, like there's some sort of Tom Hanks Castaway type character, that's not the case. These are albums, and sometimes they're just albums we like and artists we want to talk to.
Well, that's true, and don't be so literal.
Oh, right. 100%, yeah.
I know the word abandoned has some negative connotation to it, and words matter, language matters, all that is true, but just don't be so literal with the word. But yeah, you're right, Keith. Sometimes people take it to be very literal and they get a little bit defensive about it.
Yeah, and I probably have a tendency to get a little defensive about it. But in any event, so Rob and I have each selected one record. Rob, do you have any coins on you?
Coins?
Like a coin toss, so we can see who's going to reveal theirs first.
Not in my immediate vicinity. I don't think I have anything I can flip.
All right, give me one sec. All right. We're going to flip a coin to decide who reveals their abandoned album to the other one first. Rob, you can confirm. I am holding up a one U.S. quarter. One side is George Washington. And the other side is that, which one? Oh, this is a new one. It's a new quarter. So this is some guy looks to be planting a marijuana leaf.
Okay.
I don't think it's a marijuana leaf, but
We'll go with it.
Well, in any event, one side is Washington, the other side is something else. So we're going to flip it. I'm actually flipping this.
Yep.
I'm going to let it fall on my desk.
It's landed.
But neither one of us called it anything, so let's do it again. I'll flip, you call. There we go. All right, so here we go. I'm going to flip it.
Tails,
it is.
Wow, look at that, the marijuana leaf.
So do you want to receive or what's kick off or receive?
I will defer to you, Keith, and I will take the second half of this.
All right. Well, Rob, my abandoned album is not, as we said in the preamble, an abandoned album really at all.
Okay.
It's an album that continues to gain popularity, momentum, sales. It is the one and only album by a guy who was raised as Scott Moorhead. Any idea who that might be?
I don't know who that is. It's not coming to me.
It is one Jeffrey Scott Buckley, who was raised as Scott Moorhead with his stepfather and his mother. He is the son of Tim Buckley, who was a folk singer from the 70s. Jeff Buckley died early, but he only recorded one album, technically one studio record called Grace. So that is my abandoned album. What prompted me and made me revisit this, we have a friend of ours who writes on the internet about music a lot. His name is Chris Zappa. He just wrote about this record, and that's what prompted me. It never gets old for me. It's just an incredible, incredible record. In fact, his cover of Leonard Cohen's Alleluia arguably is better than the original.
I would agree. I think many, many people would agree with that.
Rolling Stone has named it one of the top 500 greatest songs of all time, which I guess that carries a little bit of gravitas to it. Time magazine called it one of the greatest songs. Yeah, it's just a fantastic, fantastic song. In fact, I didn't even know it was a Leonard Cohen song. I thought it was a Jeff Buckley song when I first heard it. And it was only later that I learned that it was Leonard Cohen. And I don't need to get into a discussion about Leonard Cohen. But yeah, it's a... Well, let's take a listen to Hallelujah by Jeff Buckley. Jeff Buckley began his musical career in California, kicking around, doing the music journeyman thing, playing with, various types of jazz, reggae, roots rock, and heavy metal bands, earning his wings, as they will say. And then in February of 1990, Buckley moved from California to New York City, and that lasted all of 9 months. And then Tim Buckley's former manager summoned him back to California with the promise of subsidizing a demo tape that they could then shop around to record labels. The four-song demo tape that Buckley made while he was in Los Angeles contained two songs that ended up on the album Grace, that's Eternal Life, and an early version of Last Goodbye titled Unforgiven, and two other songs, Strawberry Street, which pops up on the Grace Legacy Edition, and then a punk song called Radio. But, alas, no record label took interest. And then he came back to New York to do an event called Greetings from Tim Buckley at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn. Legend has it that it was at that Greetings from Tim Buckley event at St. Anne's Warehouse, Jeff Buckley all but blew everybody away. So after all this bi-coastal ping-ponging, Jeff eventually moved to New York and settled into the Lower East Side and began playing with Captain Beefheart alum Gary Lucas in his band, Gods and Monsters. Gary Lucas would go on to co-write two songs with Jeff Buckley that appear on that debut album, Grace, the title track, Grace, as well as Mojo Pin. Jeff Buckley eventually landed a Monday night residency at the club Cine, and it was there that people, industry people, eventually began to take notice. And eventually he signed with Columbia Records.
What year was that?
He signed with Columbia in 1992 for allegedly $1 million deal, $1 million three album deal, which is something. 1992, $1 million is nothing to, it's not, still not anything to sneeze at, but.
No. And it's amazing if you think about his music, what it sounded like. Pretty impressive because music, as you know, was not, it didn't sound anything like what he was doing, so you wouldn't think the major labels would be all over him.
In a case like Jeff Buckley, I think I have to give a tip of the hat to the record labels for having one of the few times they actually had foresight into seeing just how good an artist is and could be.
You're right. They do deserve credit for recognizing that he was extremely talented.
Yeah, and the A&R guy was Steve Berkowitz. One can only hope he's not related to another famous New Yorker with the surname of Berkowitz.
How did I know you were going to go there?
One of the things that makes Grace so incredible, at least in a historical perspective, is if you think about it, when it was released, it sounded like nothing that was being done at the time. And there's probably two very good reasons for that. Three very good reasons for that. One, Jeff Buckley's talent. 2, he was working with the top-notch producer, Andy Wallace. And 3, Buckley had amassed a few musicians who were extremely gifted and helped him realize his vision. And he rehearsed the fuck out of the band. He rehearsed the fuck out of the songs. And then they decamped from the city to Woodstock, New York, in the famous Bearsville Studios, where they spent 6 weeks tracking. 6 weeks. That's a lot.
It's a long time.
So that's, I mean, 6 weeks is just an insane amount of time for basic tracking. And then Jeff Buckley went back to the city to do some overdubbing in Manhattan and New Jersey. You know, you got to give the guy credit. He had a vision, and he allegedly performed take after take after take to make sure he got the perfect vocals that he wanted. And he would add instruments and take instruments away and all sorts of overdubs in order to add specific textures to each of the songs. And I think that shows on Grace.
Yeah. I don't think you get an album that well done without that kind of preparation and dedication. I mean, sometimes there's just all the stars have aligned and everything happens and people go in and a couple of takes, they got a masterpiece, but that's not the norm. So he knew, I think he knew, you know, he had something to work with.
For sure. Grace was eventually released in August of 1994. There were 7 original songs, or co-written songs, and then there were 3 covers. Lilac Wine, which was based on the Nina Simone version, the aforementioned Alleluia by Leonard Cohen, and Corpus Christi Carol, based on a 15th century hymn. So just take a second and think about the scope of just those 3 songs, those 3 covers, one by, you know, one of the most gifted vocalists in music, as far as I'm concerned, Nina Simone, one of the most respected and revered songwriters of any generation, Leonard Cohen, and some obscure 15th century hymn.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, covering the Stones.
Now, at the time, he was 28 years old.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You know what I was doing at 28 years old?
I have an idea.
Yeah. it most of it was legal.
Yeah.
Most of it. The record came out, and I don't remember how I found out about it. Probably one of the music magazines. The song that immediately grabbed me is Last Goodbye. I don't know why, man. There's just something about that song. And I can't tell you how many Sad Bastard mixtapes that song ended up on. I still listen to that song almost religiously. I don't know what that says about me.
This is our last goodbye. I hate to feel the love between us die. It's over. Just do this and then I'll go. You gave me more to live for, more than you'll ever know. This is our last embrace. Must I dream?
So as he's touring Grace in 94, he gets, you know, accolades from some of his biggest influences, like Jimmy Page, who considered Grace, quote, his favorite album of the decade.
That's pretty high praise.
Yes. Bob Dylan also called Jeff Buckley one of the great songwriters of this decade, and none other than David Bowie named Grace as one of the 10 albums he'd bring with him to a desert island.
Think of the names that you just rattled off and the praise associated with it. I mean, there's three of the greatest musicians of our lifetime, and, you know, probably ever. And I mean, you know, what else? What do you do after that?
It's unreal. And if you have never heard Grace, I encourage you to do so. I had the good fortune to see Jeff Buckley live here in New Haven at a place called Toad's Place. And I remember I went with my then girlfriend. And, you know, he was wearing his trademark white V-neck T-shirt. I mean, I don't care what gender you are, your sexual affiliation. There's nobody who wore a white V-neck T-shirt better than Jeff Buckley. Nobody. And I recall the show being a little mundane. And I hate saying that because here I am. It's one of my favorite records of all time. But the show is a little boring until the set closer. The MC5's Kick Out the Jams.
Kick out the jams, motherfucker!
Boy, did he and his band kick out the jams. I mean, he tore that place apart. For as bored as I might have been for the, you know, 45, 50 minutes prior to that, those last 10, 15 minutes were just fucking incredible to see him that charged up and tearing around this tiny little stage. Oh, it was just insane. You know, after he got done touring Grace, he went to record his follow-up record, flew down to Memphis, and if you know who Jeff Buckley is, then you know what happened. He died drowning in the Mississippi River. The Mississippi took him. And if you're thinking it was because of drugs or alcohol, not the case. He was clean as a whistle when they did the autopsy. Just got caught in the undertow of a tugboat. That was that. He drowned. It is easily one of the greatest losses, I think, in music.
Yeah.
That's a bold statement. That may sound hyperbolic to some of you, but I would ask you to listen to Grace and then tell me that it's not true.
I always wondered what he would do afterwards. Not immediately, you know, but throughout his career, because going back to what you said before about all the praise that was heaped on him from, you know, the biggest of the big in the music industry.
Not only did Buckley make Memphis his home recently, he also had plans to cut his next album here. That won't happen now, and his friends say that's everybody's loss.
I mean, this is just an absolute tragic loss for the music industry worldwide. I mean, he touched so many people with his music worldwide.
Action News 5.
We were all robbed of, you know, what else he was going to create on the back of such a successful and brilliant record.
I don't know. I mean, a who's who of modern musicians, rock stars, whatever, artists, whatever we want to call them, have been touched or influenced or impacted by Jeff Buckley's Grace. And there's no denying that. And if you listen to that record today, you'd be hard pressed to believe it's almost 30 years old.
Yeah. Well, it's timeless for a number of reasons, but I think the most important, at least to me, is, hi, Rocky. Rocky the knucklehead. The thing that I think Jeff Buckley had and what's on that record, and Keith, we talk about this, you know, on our podcast, and we talk about it offline when we're just talking about music, but it shows you how important vulnerability is in music and being vulnerable and allowing that to come through in your art, because musicians are human and human beings somehow are always drawn to people who are being vulnerable, being authentic. And that's what he was. That's what it sounded like. And how are you not drawn to that? So it doesn't surprise me that it's continuing to sell. New audiences are getting introduced to it, because the second you hear it, you know, there are emotions attached to that music that you kind of think are probably written for you.
You bring up a good point about vulnerability, but I think I learned this only recently, that it's not just for musicians or artists or anybody. It's for all of us. We all have to learn a little bit more about vulnerability and how to, especially as guys, we're not programmed that way. From an early age, we're not programmed to be vulnerable. So, I only learned that recently, and I'm still pretty shitty at it. But, you know, we're all works in progress.
It's definitely something that it's an ongoing process that everybody has to learn. And
And we've got a great soundtrack as you forage your way through the forest of vulnerability.
We do.
Jeff Buckley's Grace.
Your abandoned album of our 2022 birthday mid-season show.
All right, so you're up, Mr. Janicki.
My abandoned album is, I'm going to be a little bit different than yours because mine truly is an abandoned album in terms of both commercial success and it's quite old at this point, so reviving it might be difficult for some. But if you know, you know. And hopefully maybe I can try and get some new people to know about this record now. The band is one of my favorite bands, has been for quite some time, going all the way back to the early 80s. And they would be the Violent Femmes. The Violent Femmes have been known for their 1983 song Blister in the Sun, which was on their debut record, and that song lives in infamy through to today. But they've got a body of work that's really, really impressive from then till now. They're a very important band in the world of alternative music. They've influenced countless bands, never really got a ton of commercial notoriety outside of that song, but their albums are always cited by other musicians as being, you know, hugely influential. And amongst their fans, a lot of their albums, you know, are big, and I just did air quotes, amongst all their fans. There's one record, however, that is not, and it's called New Times. And that's the record I wanted to talk about today, because even in the Violent Femmes world, this album seems to have gotten lost, and some people don't even like it because it was a major departure from songs like Blister in the Sun or Gone Daddy Gone, or even the record that came out before New Times, which is Why Do Birds Sing, and that was released in 1991, and that got some really good airplay, MTV play, kind of put them in the spotlight for a bit. And then New Times came out in 1994, and it was the first record without their original drummer, Victor DiLorenzo. He had left, and so I guess the guys, you know, Gordon Gano and Brian Ritchie, the other two original members, were like, well, we're going to bring in a new drummer, so let's do a bunch of new things. So they brought in a guy called Guy Hoffman. Hey, a guy called Guy. And they created this album that is, now, if you know the Violent Femmes, they're kind of eclectic. I think that's a word you could use for them.
Safe word.
This album is an eclectic Violent Femmes album, which means it's wacky. There's a lot of music on this album that does not sound anything like a proper Violent Femmes album, but there are enough songs that do. So it's kind of like you're listening to maybe a Violent Femmes EP with this hidden album of experimentation in the middle of it. So there's enough Violent Femmes material that old fans should really have liked. But I think the newer sounds, I mean, there's one song on here called Machine that is all computerized. And it sounds like what Radiohead had done years later. So it was really very kind of before its time, I think. Machine come out after Radiohead did all their, you know, electronic stuff, people would have said, oh, wow, they're ripping off Radiohead. What are they doing? Yeah, but they kind of did it a little before them. So they were groundbreaking. But there are songs on here that are like waltzes. There are songs that are straight up blues rock songs, which wasn't really their thing. They've got some show tune-esque songs. I mean, it's really weird. It's a very strange record, but it's great to me. I mean, you know, if you're a fan of the Violent Femmes, and Keith, I'm not sure how much of them you know.
Outside of Blister in the Sun, I know nothing.
Okay.
You ever want to see a bunch of, now old people dancing at a wedding? Just put on Blister in the Sun.
Absolutely. They've got this punk rock vibe to them, but it's pretty much all acoustic. And they're always a three-piece when they record, and usually when they tour, too. Brian Ritchie plays an incredible, he's a great musician. His bass playing is unreal. And a lot of it is done on the acoustic bass, which is hard to do because they're playing punk music and it's not amplified. And he's just going berserk on so many of the songs. And then Gordon Gano has this very distinct voice and he's playing usually these jangly guitar riffs. And then the drummer, whether it be DiLorenzo or Hoffman, stands up while he plays. Basically has one or two drums in front of him, and he usually uses brushes. The instrumentation is kind of sparse, but they make such an interesting noise with what they're using. And with New Times, it's not like that at all. It's not, there's a, like I said, there are a few, but there's all different sounds, different song structures, long songs in some cases, 4.5 minutes. A lot of the songs are over 4 minutes. Some are 4.5 minutes. And most of Violent Femmes songs prior to that, 2 minute songs, 2.5 minute songs, maybe three. But this record, they did a lot of experimenting. The writing, the lyrical writing on here is probably deeper and more introspective and sort of, I don't know, stream of consciousness at times too, from Gano, because he's the main songwriter. I mean, Brian Ritchie does write, gets, you know, songwriting credits, and but for the most part, Gordon Gano writes all the songs. And I think he really fell into his own or came into his own on this record. And it's unfortunate because so many people just did not like it.
So Rob, who produced this and what label were they on?
This album was on Elektra and it was actually self-produced. Brian Ritchie and Gordon Gano produced it themselves, which makes sense if you agree with any of the things I was saying earlier, because it was such an eclectic record and a departure from what they were doing prior. I guess they wanted or didn't want any outside influence, because think about it, they were already a very popular band with a signature sound. So a producer would come in and say, hey guys, this isn't a Violent Femmes record, what are you doing? Like, you know, get back to your roots. So they probably didn't want that influence. That's simply my guess based on how different this album is. It was 1994, or it was released in 94.
1994 was just the peak of, you know, almost anything could get on the radio. I mean, you know, like we talked about with Eric Buettner, you know, the Butthole Surfers. People had to get real comfortable with hearing the Butthole Surfers, both their music and the name of the band uttered on FM radio.
That's a good point, because this would be the time for experimentation.
Yeah.
Violent Femmes never really fit into a category. You could obviously not call them grunge. They barely skated the alternative world, because really what they were and are, they're their own thing. They're their own genre. I mean, you know, people like to call it, you know, acoustic punk, or, you know, little bits of even rockabilly, or it's an odd thing. They don't have a name that fits all of their music. So yeah, in 94, I guess they would have been able to do anything really and get away with it like you're talking about. But nothing really stuck from this record. I mean, there's a couple of songs on here, Breaking Up, it's not my English. The song is Breaking Up, not Breaking Up. But Breaking Up is a song that could have been on the radio and might have gotten a little airplay if I'm remembering right back then. I'm Nothing is a really cool song. It's just and that's one of the ones that's like an old Violent Femmes song. It's just an acoustic song where Gano is basically telling everybody he's nothing. He's nothing in terms of being labeled, religion, politics, sexuality, even career. Like he's, you know, it's a very interesting lyric.
I am an ODA H-I-N-I-M-N-O-T-H, and I'm nothing. I'm nothing. I-M-N-O-T-H-I-N-I-M-N-O-T-H, and I'm nothing. Are you Republican or Democrat? A liberal fascist full of crap? I'm nothing. I'm nothing. Somebody somewhere might be something, but everybody everywhere knows that I'm nothing. Politics and dirty tricks, I got no time for stones and sticks. Politics and dirty tricks, I got no time for chasing chicks. I'm nothing. I'm nothing. Somebody somewhere might be something, but everybody everywhere knows that I'm not nothing. I'm nothing.
So there are a few songs on here that, you know, you can put on and you can be like, okay, cool, yeah, I hear the violent femmes in this. Then there's a lot of other stuff that's just kind of off the rails. And, you know, even in 94 with this band and their eclecticness already, yeah, I think it just kind of missed everybody. This was there and helped me, because yeah, I don't know if I can come up with anything off the top of my head, but one example I always like to use if I'm talking about these strange albums would be when Pearl Jam released No Code. No Code was a huge departure from their sound.
Going back even further, I think one could say the Beatles' Magic Mystery Tour.
You take what's known and you've built up a fan base and you don't deviate too much from a specific sound, and then you drop something that's just totally out of left field. I don't always like that. I mean, I am a creature of habit sometimes, especially when it comes to music. I think we all have a little bit of that in us where you want to hear, like, you know, you usually like a band because you like their sound and you like their style. So you don't want them to go too far left of that, I guess. And in this case, though, this is one of my favorite Violent Femmes albums. And most fans of the band would not say that. So to me, this is truly an abandoned album. It didn't sell at all. And their hardcore fans kind of like don't want to listen to it. So, you know, I might be alone with this one, but, you know, it is one of my favorite records of the 90s. And I really do think if people really gave it a chance, really had an open mind while listening to some of these songs and get Blister in the Sun out of their head, they'd get into this.
Did the band get dropped after this record?
Yeah, so their next record came out on the Mushroom label.
They got dropped.
And that's the thing. And that goes back to a point we always talk about on abandoned albums, usually because it's brought up by the artist, that the labels won't have the foresight or the time or the patience or the know-how to work with a band that's doing something slightly different than what they're known for, because they know it's not going to sell, or they think it's not going to sell, and they just say, no, we're not doing this anymore.
Isn't that great? Because we've got a contrast in that between the two records we selected, right? Because we've got the one, Jeff Buckley's Grace. Clearly, there was some foresight. They signed the guy to a 3-album deal for $1 million+. He spent 6 weeks basic tracking before going back to the city at 2 different studios, relentlessly and tirelessly overdubbing to get the perfect sound for his vocals, for his instrumentation. And the results are there, and here we are 30 years later, the album still holds up. And a tip of the hat to Columbia Records and the A&R guy, Steve Berkowitz. Again, still not sure if he's related to the more infamous Berkowitz, but clearly Steve Berkowitz is the guy with the talent and the foresight to do that. And your album, on the other hand, Elektra, didn't have.
I'm trying to think of all the different artists we've spoken to over the last couple of seasons, and your example with Grace is the only one, I think, where the label really got it right.
Well, you know, I'm gonna push back a little bit on that, because I think MCA gave it a go with Broken Homes.
That is true. They did fulfill their 3-record deal. They did,
and,
right?
And yeah, they did, and they tried.
Yeah.
And there are the birds telling me that it's the end of the episode. Many thanks again to Chris Zappa for reminding me of just how good Jeff Buckley's Grace is. And thanks to you, Rob, for pointing out how good the Violent Femmes album, New Times, actually is.
Your choice today proves that word, abandoned, should not be taken literally.
The songs you heard during this podcast were Hallelujah, Grace, and Last Goodbye, all taken from Jeff Buckley's album, Grace. You also heard the songs Machine and I'm Nothing, taken from the Violent Femmes album, New Times. Additionally, you heard a sample of Kick Out the Jams by the MC5. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums, and on Instagram, we are at @abandon_albums.
As always, thanks to Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Nathan Sage, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, and of course, our executive producer, Rufus Thunderlove.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.